may remember that the last time we met here, we laid considerable emphasis upon the necessity to live here and now, every moment of our lives, in terms of love, wisdom, truth, purity. You may remember the reason, or the reasons that lay behind this statement. If we are able to free the mind, to empty the mind of all its distorted images, we will see that all the consolatory doctrines, the wishful thinking in the theologies of the world have to be given up altogether. All ideas about a hereafter, about a continuance, about a goal that has to be achieved by the individual, are all false ideas. They have a shadow of truth in them, but that truth is something unknown to us. What we cling on to is the shadow. And we do this because our discriminative consciousness is aware of our existence only in tainted terms, tainted by greed, hate, delusion. We cannot be free of that. Our very structure brings that about. Because the brain is not a pure instrument. It has at least a threefold functioning, one which may be described as reptilian, another as lower mammalian, and a third, the highest, the neocortex up there, which is very, very advanced, and it has developed in the last 500,000 years out of all proportion to the other two aspects of the brain. This organism of ours, descended from the animal, inevitably gives us the heritage of fear, of aggressiveness, of greed, of ignorance, delusion, and all the rest of it. So that our consciousness is unable to be awake to the world as it actually is, in a pure way, in a truthful way. Our consciousness is tainted all along the line with greed, hate, delusion, and all the other ill qualities. We are not concerned about the good qualities because they are no problem. It's the ill qualities which make the problem. Now, I think we saw that point. And therefore, all this wishful thinking which you see in the theologies is born of that tainted awareness of existence. Now, when one is really concerned with truth, and one is prepared to go through the total process by which all selfness is out of a situation, so that the individual person is the instrument through which the total reality comes to self-awareness. When we are like that, when we do that, we throw out every single idea, every single teaching that has been given to us. We know that it is not the truth. This is not the truth. This is not the ultimate reality. And when we come to that state of ultimate reality, It is a state where the mind is totally empty. It is completely luminous, therefore, in the sense that it is completely transparent. This transparency means that the world as it actually is, making its impact on us, does not get distorted by our tainted consciousness, because the mind is now the universal mind, in fact. It's no longer my mind or your mind. It is as if it were a universal mind. And all the problems which we have inherited, which are locked up, not only in the brain, but in the very cells of our body, they can no longer limit us. They exist simply because the body exists. But the person is awake in the real sense because he's emptied his mind of all images. Now, one of the tremendous consequences of throwing out all the comforting beliefs and systems and the charming little promises of a hereafter and you'll get a reward and so forth, they are false. We will see that whatsoever human beings have suffered will never be recompensed unto them in any shape or form. Whatever anyone suffers now, whatever is wrong now, can never be righted afterwards. You see, it's no good saying he will have a future where it will be a little bit better and it will be a little bit better and all the rest of it till you get to the top of the mountain and so forth. No such thing happens. Therefore, the only redemption, the only salvation for man is that each and every one of us will live now completely, utterly in terms of the purest love, wisdom, truth, and purity. Because whatsoever hurt I may cause to another or to myself can never be undone. There can be no recompense for it. Therefore, this absolute transcendental ethic becomes imperative for us. There is no other way. Now, it's all very well to say this. It's all very well to give our intellectual assent to it. We may say, oh yes, this seems quite logical, this is the right thing. How do we do it? Let us first look at this matter of intellectual assent. An intellectual assent, which is based upon logical deduction primarily, has an extremely unsure foundation, because the remarkably powerful forces that actually move us in our life and determine our actions is not the intellect. It is this irrational, subconscious, demonic side of us, so to say. All the inherited drives, the aggressiveness, the greed, the selfness, all that takes place inevitably. We are blind to it. We don't know that we are doing it. You see? We don't know it. So that the mere intellectual assent, at best, only raises up a state of conflict when we do become aware of what we are doing. And if we act because our intellect is in conflict with the natural drive, then our action bears all the fruits of conflict. And that conflict only means a turning of the kaleidoscope into another pattern of disharmony. We may, for instance, wake up to the fact suddenly, oh, but this is not acting in the light of wisdom, or this is not acting according to the dictates of love. No, no, I mustn't do this, I must do the other. And that other is an opposite. Is it not? Well, if I just set up an opposite against this, which is my actual action or drive, I am in conflict, in the state of conflict. And that does not solve the problem. We have to work not for solution, but for resolution, in the musical sense of the term. If you have a problem in mathematics, you solve it, as we say. But in music, we do not solve anything. With music, the parts of the music, as you all know, move into positions of discord and out into positions of concord and back again into positions of discord and so forth. And the overriding effect, the overall effect of making the parts move in the right manner, in both into positions of discord and concord, is actually harmony. The overall thing is the harmony. And we say that we resolve the discord into a concord. Now you see, there is no part of the music which has arrived at the position of discord which is destroyed or put into opposition with something else. It is made to move in such a manner, it maintains its own integrity. It is made to move in such a manner that it arrives at the position of concord and so forth. Now this is very different. This is an integrating process. Nothing is destroyed. Everything is utilized in the right manner. And therefore you get beauty, harmony, perfection. This way, there is a transcendence. This is a real experiencing and an example of transcendence in operation. Not a case of destroying this because it is bad, out with it, and we'll cultivate this because we think it is good. And in any case, what I think is good is thought by a consciousness which is already a tainted consciousness. See? So that, where the resolution is concerned, the way is what has always been called mindfulness. Attentiveness. Now what happens in the ordinary way? Here is a quality, here is its opposite. We call this good, we call that bad or evil. And the ordinary procedure in the world is, the moment one comes across and is conscious of the evil, to fight against it in terms of what is commonly called the good. As I said, that is merely the state of conflict. That does not produce a resolution, a resolving. It is a violent attempt to solve. And it is always an attempt to solve in accordance with what my tainted consciousness regards as good. So that there is no resolution, there is no final harmony, no real clarity, no real understanding, or wisdom, or anything like that coming out of that. It is always a conflict, a state of struggle, a senseless state of struggle. But supposing one attends completely to whatever is, either this, what is commonly called the good, or to that which is commonly called the evil, if one completely attends to it, and just follows it in inner observation, then it becomes completely worked out. And what emerges out of that is not an opposite which I thought good, but a real harmony which comes into being by itself. How and why? Because that which is being observed is myself, my own psychical self. I can't throw it out saying, oh, this is bad, I'll throw it out. I can't. It is myself. If I throw it out, I will only replace it in all probability by a worse evil. This is what happens. Out went, one devil was driven out of the house, you remember, a lovely story. And seven devils came in. They found a nice, clean, new place as they are aboard. So now, we have to bear this in mind. That this complete attention, without doing anything about it, but a complete attentiveness will come to that pitch where at last there will be complete clarity, and in that complete clarity there will spontaneously emerge the right action. Not the premeditated action. Because the premeditated action, after all, is tainted by all my desires, my greeds, and my so-called interests, my purposes, and all the rest of it. And they are always my purposes, and they are always self-purposes, however much I may try to fool myself by identifying myself with the cause, the community, with the great teachers, with God, or whatever I like. That's all nonsense, this identification. In the name of the highest. As we all know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And the quickest road to hell is paved with the best intentions. So now, this living in terms of absolute love, wisdom, purity, truth, simplicity, if you like, all that we can do about it is to see the necessity for it. If we really see the necessity, inwardly, there will be such a passion, a pure passion for this, that one's whole psychical energy will be at the service of the best, which will emerge by itself spontaneously. We are all so conceited. We think, oh, I am going to do this. I am determined to do this. And I shall devote my whole life and all my energy to bringing about such and such an excellent result. I don't know anything about excellent results. I really don't. When I know the one and only thing that we here can know, is that we do not know. When we really know that we do not know, this inner turmoil of the psyche ceases. When that inner turmoil of the psyche ceases, the naturally harmonious life process emerges, takes charge, and does the right thing. You know how again and again a man riding on a horse loses his way in the forest. He lets the horse finally just find the way out. He doesn't direct it anymore. That's a well-known fact, isn't it? And it is the same with ourselves. We can regard the body as the horse on which we ride, so to say, you see. And the body has a wisdom of its own. Now, this wisdom of the body is not a mere material body wisdom, because the body is the whole thing. It is one of our illusions that this is the body, and oh, I've got a mind, and I've got a spirit, and I've got wonderful things. I haven't anything of the sort. It is there. All right. This thing which is here in its totality, I do not know. I do not know all its potentialities. What extraordinary things will emerge out of it, naturally. If I am quiet in my mind, then this life energy, in all its marvel, its perfection, will flow out and put things right. People may say, but this is a lovely idea. Have you got the least evidence for it? I say, yes. Cut your finger. Now, who does the healing? I? It heals, doesn't it? You just need to learn. Don't do anything else which is going to add to the folly of having cut the finger. Don't add to the folly or the mischief. Just keep quiet. And lo and behold, it will heal. It will become whole. The universe runs itself. I don't run the universe. But unfortunately, I think there are some in the world, at least, if not many, who think that, they didn't hustle about and bustle about, everything would run down. What would happen? Like the dear housewife who said that, but somebody's got to worry. Let us relate this attentiveness to something else. If I, as I am, try to pay total attention to whatever the immediate situation is and to whatever the reactions in my mind are to the immediate situation, who is paying attention? What sort of a person is paying this attention? I am a person whose mind is already filled with illusions, with delusions, and so forth. Take the commonest illusion which springs up in the religious-minded person. He tries earnestly to look at everything from the point of view of God, or of the Master, or of the truth, or the perfect, or perfection, or whatever it is. But what an extraordinary illusion. How can I look at anything from the point of view of God? It's perfectly ridiculous. Supposing I'm in my first year at school, and I've just begun to learn a little physics or chemistry. Can I regard the subject from the point of view of the professor in the university? I haven't got the capacity. I'm not fitted for it. Obviously not. But it never strikes us that in this sphere of religion, of the deep things of life, just the same applies. Look at the charmingly absurd way in which pious people, devoted people will say that, so I prayed to God and he gave such and such an answer. We are on visiting terms. Not only are we on visiting terms, I do understand God's language. Another implication. Well, I am already must be a super marvelous person to be able to do that, mustn't I? So you see, in the act of attention, it is a person who is already tainted who is attending, so his attention is always being tainted, isn't it? See, I'm trying to point out the difficulties, the problems. We are awful simpletons where the holy life is concerned. Really, we are awful simpletons. We can be simple, but to be simple is not to be a simpleton. When Bach composed his marvelous fugues and so on, and one listens, it sounds, and if it is perfectly played, it all sounds so simple and all the rest of it. Just look, analyze that fugue and see the marvelous complexity of it. It is not complicated, because that means it would be diseased. When one is diseased, one says a complication has set in. But the healthy organism, or the beautiful fugue, has tremendous complexity, but everything is so perfectly related that the simplicity which underlies it stands out and gives the impression of beauty and perfection. So now, if we realize that our attentiveness is complicated, it's in a state of dis-ease, and instead of being simpletons, we have to arrive at simplicity, then it means that we have to understand all the elements that make up that complexity. And in order to understand all the elements that make up that complexity, we must be able to look into our images, the images in the mind, the beliefs, the convictions, the fantasies, the ideas, and all the rest of it. This is, I have mentioned more or less the purely intellectual things. There are all the other things, the drives, the fear, the hate, the greed, and so forth. Now consider, all of us who in some form or other try to practice religious disciplines, to live the holy life, consider one point to start with. Is there or is there not the drive to attain a desired goal? And is not there a picture, more or less definite, of what that desired goal is? But the Buddha taught, for instance, amongst other great teachers, he taught quite clearly that it is desire, the drive of tainted desire, which lies at the root of suffering and sorrow and so forth. He taught that all ideas which we may have, all pictures that we may make in our own minds, are impermanent, they are sources of suffering, and they have no relationship to ultimate truth, to reality. Therefore, he said, do not grasp at them. But when we embark upon a special technique, a special way, which we call the practice of the religious life, we have this desire strongly in ourselves, and we have a picture of the goal. If we haven't a picture, at least we have a name, heaven, nirvana, fellowship with God, as Christian theologians would put it. And we have our little pictures of fellowship with God. I, John Brown, am there, God is there, see, there are the great angels, there's Jesus Christ, there's Paul and Peter and John and Jim and Derek and Harry and everybody else. You see, everybody's there. And of course, I'm only a little chap, so I'll be down here, you know. But I'll enjoy the whole thing. I'll have all my share of the cake, the divine cake. No, but this is, I'm putting it in an absurd form. But isn't this really seriously so? Now you see, this is what we must be awake to. Not merely when we are conversing together, not merely when somehow or other our interest for the moment turns our thought to it, but in the ordinary course of life. This is where the problem comes. To be holy whilst cleaning up the house with only 5 minutes to go before catching the bus or the train, that is the time to be awake, and awake in the sense of holy awakening. This is different. This is a very arduous task. This is not for the weaklings, so to say. When we become conscious of being, of our weakness in some form or other, of our inadequacy, then we immediately draw out of the unconscious depths, the hidden depths of our mind, all the consolatory ideas, all the procrastinative ideas, putting off for tomorrow. Oh, never mind, I failed now, but next time. There may never be a next time. Next moment I may be dead, and I shall have failed. Isn't that so? One can be wholly awake even when one is very tired, even when one is asleep. One can be wholly awake if one has seen with a total, overwhelming passion the absolute need for living by a transcendental ethic. And then these difficulties, every one of them will be a wonderful teacher. Every one of them will tell me just what I actually am at the moment. See? And if I don't conflict with myself, but see my state as it is and let it go, out of that will emerge the flower of wisdom, the beauty of pure love and understanding. That is how it happens. And it is accompanied always with freedom from all the false images. Now, this is extremely . You see the implications of it. There are so many implications. Consider one only, for instance. To what do we give our allegiance? To ideas, isn't it? But if we see that the idea is a tainted thing, that we have to let it go, otherwise life doesn't flow, it becomes a block to further emergence. If we have to let it go, then with it goes our allegiance also. But oh no, we cling to the idea, don't we? Oh no, this is the truth. You have to be absolutely true to all that the party says we ought to do. So we remain slaves. One isn't awake. And in being true to the party, true to my idea or your idea or whatever it is, I have to be in conflict with a different idea. Not necessarily an opposing idea, but with a different idea. And the different idea is held by another person, so I have to be in conflict with that person. How then can I live by the ethic of love? if I'm in conflict with the other person. You see, this idea which I hold is myself, isn't it? It is that which distinguishes this living organism from what I call the other person. But when I am prepared not to grasp at, not to be the slave of the idea, then the me-ness, the I-ness of this organism is out of the situation. There is only the unity, the one. Then there is love. Nothing sentimental, nothing emotional, nothing which is hedged about by thought. Everything which is hedged about by the thinking process as such is loveless. When the mind is totally open and the heart is totally free, then love is the result. And it will inevitably produce its own appropriate action. Inevitably it will do it. But this open-mindedness means the images disappear. And the natural sensitivity of the living organism, this receptive, responsive sensitivity, which is mind, functions absolutely unhindered. It is in this condition that one knows the mind of another. You know, it is said in the New Testament again and again, but Jesus knew what was in the minds of the others. And of the Buddha it is said openly again and again, he says of himself, I knew by my mind what was in the other person's mind or the event which was taking place elsewhere. Of course, he may have not said the truth. But supposing he said the truth, it is extremely instructive. What happens when a person is pure? His purity first and foremost means that the mind is luminous. It is empty of all images. Thoughts and feelings and all the rest just flow through harmoniously. But he never grasps at anything. A Buddha thinks, of course. But as he thinks, the thoughts just go out, he never grasps at them. This is the sign of perfection, of holiness. So, this sensitivity is functioning unhindered at its highest pitch. And because he himself is in this state of complete quietness inside, all that is going on in the immaterial sphere which we call mind makes an impress on his brain and he knows it. The brain is like a receiving set. It's like a receiving set. Don't stretch the analogy too far. It's like a receiving set. There are waves at all sorts of wavelengths going through. And maybe that with the human being who has realized total purity, this receiving set of the brain, unlike a wireless set, which just you have to turn a knob and get it to a particular wavelength, is sensitive on all wavelengths. Perhaps one of the meanings underlying the statement that the perfected holy ones are omniscient. This does not mean that they know everything in the sense of encyclopedic knowledge. And as a matter of fact, we have more than ample evidence that they never did know. In that sense. Because if they did, they could easily have foretold the whole of the future accurately. And not one of them foretold anything more accurately than any man of penetration and good sense could have seen for himself. And they were all wrong, as a matter of fact, in some of the things that are actually attributed to them. Both Jesus and the Buddha, with their foretelling, were hopeless. Sometimes your astrologers and palmists do better. Jesus said, some of you living here will see the Son of Man coming in clouds of glory. And none of them did. It didn't take place. It raised one of the very solemn and serious problems in the Christian church after his death. The Buddha said, the Dhamma will live for 500 years, 1,000 years, etc., etc. All that is stuff. Nothing of the sort has happened in the form in which it has been presented. Nothing like that. But the omniscience perhaps means this total and complete sensitivity, because there is no selfness left now. Once the images are out, and the images are out, at the same time as all grasping has ceased, then there is the enlightened state. This is important, isn't it? So, another very important aspect of all this is that where the religious life is concerned, where religious growth is concerned, the way is not what the world would call a positive way. It is what the world would call the negative way. It is not this, not this, not that, not that. It is something else. But the something else is not a limited, a particular, a finite thing. It is the unlimited, the infinite, the immeasurable, the transcendent. But where are we then? Having said it is not this, it is not this, it is not that, through the realization of the infinite, the immeasurable, the transcendent, all this gets included. And you see the relationships of everything now. When one sees all things in their harmonious and perfect relationships, the universe at last becomes a universe in fact for us. Until then it's a word. We say universe, but we don't mean universe. For us it's all bits and bobs. This bit I like, that bit I don't like. A universe is a harmonious whole. Like a perfect symphony or a sonata is a harmonious, or a song is a harmonious whole. Songs perhaps are wonderful examples of it. Really wonderful examples. So now, this harmonious wholeness This awakening to the complete relationships between all the ephemeral passing objects and events that make up the life of the universe gives us some clue to the meaning of space and mind. We have considered this a little bit before, on previous occasions. We say space, but we don't know what space is. It is because there are objects and we see, we measure the distance between them. We say that these two objects are contained in space. We say things and ourselves are in space. Might it be that we are not so much things and persons in space, but that we are of space? This object here, this carpet, me, the person, each of these is space which is warped, which has become twisted, which has become compressed, which has become concretized. Might it be so? Don't say it's an interesting thought. Try and just feel it out. You see, after all, if you take space in the ordinary scientific way, with what we call our scientific minds, we say, oh, this vast, vast space, and all the galaxies put together really are like a single fly in Waterloo Station, empty otherwise, you see. But you see, in our minds is the concept of a vast emptiness, an absolute blank, a nothingness, inside which somehow a fly appears. This is the totality of the 2,000 million galaxies that there are, or whatever it is. But is it like that? Might it not be something very, very different? That space is the total reality in itself, and wheresoever space experiences a little tummy ache or a sneeze or something like that, lo and behold, a galaxy appears. It is the tension, the stress and strain in space which is the observable material in space. Now, if that is the case, or something like that is the case, are we not, is not everything a sort of a warping of space, a sort of a spoiling of space, space twisted, space made bad, made ill? And it's a curious thing that the word dukkha, its etymological derivation is du, meaning either far from or made bad, something spoiled. And kha is infinity. Infinity spoiled. But this infinity is space. Therefore, space is not merely the empty container. It is totality. And the totality is so overwhelmingly total that we, constituted as we are, become conscious only of its illnesses, its warpings. Understand this, and you will really penetrate, begin to penetrate anyway, into shunyata, the meaning of the emptiness as presented in Mahayana Buddhism. You see, there is no such thing as a hollow, an empty hollow as we commonly call it, unless there is an external swelling, an external swelling. This is very important. If we talk about absolute truth, then we are talking in these terms. Now just picture it carefully. If you have a soap bubble, we mentioned the soap bubble, you remember, about 2 months ago. You have a soap bubble. But with a soap bubble, you've got air inside. Only because we can't see the air, we will say, for convenience sake, all right, there is nothing inside. Just for convenience sake. That film, that outer film, and the space there, we'll just call it a space, right? Now, our conception of space is that sort of conception. The space there, bounded by this. Prick that film, and the film breaks, and what happens? For us, for all practical purposes, there's a complete disappearance. It seems to us annihilation, but it isn't. The substance of that film is now invisible to us again, and that little bit of that hollow, which was the space there, because it has lost its identity as a separate bit of space into the total space, we say it's just gone. We don't say that that space is total space. You see, this is, it's helpful to see how the mind works and how it gets caught up in all sorts of conceptions which include in them misconceptions. And similarly, all misconceptions that we see and become aware of include in themselves true conceptions. This is the extraordinary part of it. Mistakes or evil or flaws are as much teachers as what are not mistakes, or what is not evil, or what is not a flaw. All right, come back to this space. We are of space. We are the stuff of space. Now, if we are the stuff of space, and we de-stuff all our images, so that the mind, that is to say, this receptive, responsive sensitivity, is at the condition, in the condition of perfect equanimity, it knows neither sorrow nor joy. It is in perfect equilibrium. And the transcendence of both sorrow and joy, pleasure and pain, is what the theistic religions, well, not merely theistic, but all call bliss. This is the peace of God which passes all understanding. It is in a state of complete equanimity. It's in a dynamic poise, a dynamic equilibrium, which is pure and untainted action, activity, all the time. It's only when disturbing activities interfere with this state that you get all the turmoil which we see as ordinary everyday life. But if in this state of equanimity we become completely free of the idea of self, it is no longer oneself being off space at all, but there is only space, then that samapatti which the Buddha talked of, entering upon and abiding in the infinity of space, takes place. But what is one of its implications? One of its deep implications? With the real absence of all the images and the ordinary drives inside us, the real dissolution of all selfness. The organism is there, mind you, the living person is there, but with the dissolution of all self-consciousness, all grasping in terms of consciousness and so forth, then this transcendent love is unhindered. Love in its transcendent reality is everlastingly there, just as space is everlastingly there. And it is this space, if you like, this akasha, as it is called, which is the same as what we call awareness or consciousness, vijnana. Hence those two samapattis are always there. Samapatti means a coalescence. It's always useful to get at the inner meanings of these words. And then you will see into the depths. So that in the infinity of space, where there are no obtrusions upon the complete and total harmony of space, there is also no obtrusion of separative discriminative consciousness. And therefore, there is the absolute wisdom there. Is this just too difficult? Because you see, naturally, when we listen to any speaker, we inevitably try to follow it with the logical intellect. That is unavoidable. And yet, in addition to the logical intellect, there is the sort of power of suggestiveness. I don't mean suggestiveness in the brainwashing sense, you see, but in the sense of a stimulus which suddenly makes the other person come alight. So you see, there is no goal to seek. It is here. The infinity, the transcendence is here all the time. I am the warping of it. When I say I don't mean just what we commonly call the body and commonly separate from the mind as if it were different. You see? But just the whole thing. Unobstructive, the transcendence is unhindered, that is all. To be unobstructive, to be unobtrusive. You know, they talk about the psychic powers which are developed. And they say that the yogi can make himself invisible. In the mythologies, in the folklore, Siegfried puts on the Tarn helm and he becomes invisible. He becomes invisible. But this is the meaning of becoming invisible. I am no longer obtrusive upon the universe. A separate self obtruding itself upon the infinity of space and the infinity of awareness, consciousness. Therefore, I am not to be seen, obviously, I can't be seen. Symbolically. Everybody will see this body, of course. Makes himself invisible. And of course, the dear millions who read this about the great, the holy ones or the great teachers, and they think that the thing happens literally. These are all idiotic ideas. But you see, these mythological forms hold profound psychological and spiritual truth. Provided one awakens. If the passion is there, there is bound to be the awakening. If the passion for it is not there, passion not as my desire to gain the truth. No. This is where the difficulty comes. But just this unspeakable thing which lets you, which which makes you just burn away with it, in an unending ecstasy of burning. It's as if I'm a leaf that has fallen off a tree, but there is no earth to reach, and therefore I go dancing, dancing forever and ever through the spaces. It's like that. That kind of passion. That kind of real being, which is not a self-surrender. I don't know how to put it here. But it has the element of self-surrender in that one doesn't hold anything for oneself. Now you see, if one realizes anything of this infinity of space and infinity of consciousness, one gets a glimpse at the real meaning of Jesus' saying. You know, in St. John's Gospel it comes, "And now, O Father, glorify thou me with the glory I had with thee before the world was." Before the world was means before there is this warping of space, of infinity, of transcendence, which is the particular individual. But this is where grace, beauty, mystery comes in. This very thing, the warping which is the particular individual, is the very instrument through which that infinitude lets its glory shine. If the warped thing will not obstruct the divine reality. We have to let it happen. We can't go pelting along in enthusiasm, you know, saying, "Now we'll achieve this marvelous, wonderful thing." Let it happen. And what I let happen is the dissolution, or if you like, the resolution of this point of discord. Make it move into the position of concord. And let it keep moving on. The negative aspect, as the world would say. The negative aspect, all the time. But this very negative thing is in fact the absolute positive. Cleanliness is there with the removal of dirt. Can never get tired of saying that. But it is so true, isn't it? You can't put cleanliness into anything. But you can remove the dirt and the thing is clean. It's like that. Alright. That means I have to be quiet. Now as we saw earlier, what we call the body is not merely the body and the mind a separate thing. All these are the mistaken ideas we have out of our ignorance. The reality is just one great reality, manifesting itself in terms of an infinite variety. But the elements which make the variety are completely interrelated with each other. And that is what makes the oneness. This absurd attempt of philosophers in connection with the question of the one and the many is all nonsense. There is no problem at all. The one is the many, and the many are the one. They constitute the one. That's all. This one-many is just because I, being limited with my perception, see it as the many, and then I start wondering, but is it all one? There is nothing to wonder about. The one is the many. The many are. It's as simple as that. Alright, so now, let's spend a few minutes Let the body be perfectly at ease, comfortably balanced. And let your attention be directed first to the solar plexus, just about there. And let that be at ease, relaxed. You will probably find that the neck, the muscles of the face, the eyes, everything gives up its strains and its stresses, and therefore it is at ease. One cannot acquire ease. One just gets free of the strains and stresses, and there is ease. All strains and stresses in the body represent also our mental, emotional strains and stresses. As you all know, the visceral region, the abdominal region. One person said the abominable region. Is the region where immediately one's emotions have effect. Fear or anger or whatever it is. You will find that the diaphragm movement will be perfectly rhythmic, harmonious, steady, simple. Then the pelvic region. The thighs, the knees, calves, feet, everything at ease. If the neck and all the facial muscles are really at ease, and the abdominal region, you will probably find that anything like a state of turmoil of thought and of the emotions will subside. And at first there will only be a sense of peace. One of two things sometimes follows. Either one gradually slides into a state of somnolence, or there is a very heightened sensitivity without excitement, without turmoil. The receiving set, so to say, will pick up any and every vibration without being upset. But more probably, after the first experience of a state of peace, you will find that things which were deep down in the hidden recesses of the mind will begin to come up. And this is where the real understanding of oneself begins. One sees oneself for what one is. The things which are repressed, the things which are unworked out, incomplete. Just observe what comes to the surface. And observing what immediately comes to the surface of the mind, relate it to its more important root. Is it fear? Is it ambition? Is it greed? Is it egoism, vanity, pride, self-conceit? What is it? Look at it. Just look at it. All this constitutes what the Buddha called tanha. Sanskrit trishna. The thirst for disturbed sentient existence. That's trishna. Sensational excitement. This is the stuff of dukkha, suffering, sorrow, the ill state, the infinite made bad. Just observe it, but observe with tremendous intensity. It is as if the eyes never flinched. It is as if a fire, a light, came out through the eyes that look. And that flame purifies the thing one is looking at. No picture behind it. What I mean is no particular desire in terms of, oh, this which I am looking ought to be like that or like that. No, no, not that. Just look. And spontaneously the healing will take place. Every one of us, somewhere, somehow, has known frustrations, deep frustrations, which hurt our ego, our amour propre. These are never forgotten, they are never forgiven. And forgetting and forgiving are quite the wrong things in the context of the transformation of the psyche in the religious context. Observe and see. Nothing can be annihilated. Everything can be transformed. The disappointments, the wrongs done to us, the wrongs we have done and about which we have conscience, the excuses that we make for ourselves, for others, all the twistings and the turnings of this rascally mind as it is caught, watch them. Don't attempt to squeeze the life out of them. That's quite futile. Just watch. Just maintain the peaceful state of the body. Maybe one's whole being will be suffused with a calm confidence that the right thing will emerge, is emerging. Don't seek to know with the mind, with the intellect, what that right thing is. The beautiful one can never know his or her own beauty with the intellect. He or she just is beautiful, just is strong, healthy. And seeing in this way, may find that compassion will naturally spring out of the heart, not as an emotional wave, but as a very quiet thing. A child falls down, and the intelligent mother picks up the howling babe and just gently says, "All right, dear, that'll be all right," instead of making a silly fuss about it all. It's that kind of thing. All right, it will be all right. Just be quiet. If one sees intensely and truly in the quietness, the transformation takes place, the resolution of the discord takes place. With the resolution of the discord, there is healing, there is health. The mind which was ill at ease, in dukkha, in suffering, is at ease. It's not in pleasure. It's at ease, it's at peace. Thank you. I've just sort of suggested some lines along which one can work. And when one practices by oneself, take any one thing which emerges on that particular occasion predominantly and pursue it. That is to say, just keep looking and see which way it goes, which means that very possibly a fantasy arises. Watch that fantasy. Which way does it go? Watch it intelligently. See the relationship of the movement of that fantasy to all the elements which make up our ordinary pleasure, pain, sorrow, joy, the duals. And as you watch, be completely awake to the fact that what you are watching is impermanent. It is the warping of infinity. And if, when it happens to be one of those occasions on which everything goes right, so to say, in the course of such meditation, you will actually experience what, for instance, Jesus meant, glorify thou me with the glory I had with thee before the world was. Don't try to bring it into a clear-cut picture in imagination. Because that will become a fixation. This is how doctrines and dogmas, fixed doctrines and dogmas emerge and imprison man. Let it emerge, let it pass away. Don't hold it. I can't hold the sunset, can I? I can't hold the beauty of the morning star. But if I see it with my total being, then eternal God has shone forth throughout the universe. And I have not obstructed, and I have not obtruded. Dick, 5 to 6 with you. Do you wish to?